Hello everybody and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm Julia Stetter, your host, and today we'll be talking to Marcel Schmidt about his new book Autopoiesis und Literatur, or in English, Autopoiesis and Literature, the short history of an interminable procedure. It analyzes works from Heinrich von Kleist and Franz Kafka for characterizing the concept of autopoiesis. Mr. Schmidt, welcome to the show.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
The pleasure is mine, and I'm looking especially forward to this interview because I've come across the term autopoiesis several times before, but never really got the time to understand it in detail. But first, could you start by telling us a bit about yourself? That is, what and where you studied and how you became interested in autopoiesis?
Okay, sure. So I actually had a pretty unlinear career. So I was at some point a car salesman. I was a high school teacher for many years. I studied history, art history, and German studies at the University of Zurich in Switzerland. And that's also where I started my PhD program in German literature. But I always spent more than half of my PhD time abroad at New York University, at Yale University, where I also met my co-advisor, Professor Rüdiger Kampe. And so I also work on very different topics. One topic is that is connected to my studies in history, like cars and technology. I'm actually working on a book right there. And I published a book on the life reform movement. And I'm now working on a new project on seriality. That is my kind of habilitations project. And so at the moment, I am a visiting postdoctoral scholar at the German department at Brown University. And I'm also a fellow of the Swiss National Science Foundation. So maybe about autopoiesis, it's kind of difficult to say. Maybe it was the same as you also said earlier. It was just like this, I always saw this term and I was wondering what it is. And then at the end of my master's degree, I had to write a paper for the finals, and that paper, and I chose the topic autopoiesis, and that's kind of how I got interested in it. And it's also, I'm interested because autopoiesis had, as like my career, also a very unlinear career. So it's from biology to theory of cognition to social studies to systems theory and so on. And it always also fascinated me that it is actually describing something that is not very easy to describe, or something that is not very easy to define.
Wow, sounds all quite impressing places and people and life. For someone who has not thought about autopoiesis before, how would you explain this rather complex concept, and are there similarities between the use of this term within literary studies and other academic fields, as you mentioned, biology or something?
Yes, and I actually also would explain it actually through the history, because that's quite interesting. So actually it is the term was invented, or first used at least, by a Chilean biologist Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. But the fun part is they already had actually kind of trouble to define it. So they used it on a basic level to describe that the human cell has all the material for self-production in itself. And from there, they used it also like self-production as a cognitional self-development. So that's the way they used it. And then, and that's very interesting, Niklas Luhmann, who for some reason seems to know the work of Maturana and Varela, and as far as I know, they even knew each other personally. He used it to describe the fact that systems, in his systems theory, are able to reproduce themselves. And then it's kind of like interesting. The next transition was actually, it was going somehow into like Germanics. So especially like literary theory and Germanics. And I assume it is, or I kind of prove in my book that it is through the influence of systems theory. Although the first one who used autopoiesis in literary theory, as far as I know, is Dietrich Schwanitz, who was like a professor of English studies, but in Germany. So it is kind of a very weird, weird history. And that's kind of a result also of my book. They all have trouble to define it. So, of course, you can like basically define it as something like that is self-production or also self-reference. But I think it's easier sometimes to describe, and that's what all people who are dealing with the term actually do, is to use just like different examples. And there are a few like very nice examples. I can maybe, if you like, I could make one example.
Yeah, please.
One would be like from the German punk rock band Die Ärzte. They have a song called Junge. I think it's like maybe 10 years ago or 8 years ago. And so in this song, they actually sing out of the position of a mother who is very annoyed by the punk son, the son who does not want to like live like the parents wish the son would.
I think I know the song. She asks, why didn't you have learned anything?
And in the refrain they always say, and always that like cruel music and those loud guitars, and exactly in that moment the loud guitars are really playing, and that is for me like a core autopoietic moment. So it is like there are several dimensions who are actually interacting with each other, and it is hard to describe and also hard to define what happens at the moment. But you see as a, you know, if you listen to a song, you can, oh yeah, that's weird. And it's actually funny. I think autopoietic moments are not always, but often very funny.
Yeah, I see. So one out of the two main texts you analyze in your book is a very short one from Heinrich von Kleist. And could you maybe begin by telling us what this text is all about?
So the short text from Heinrich von Kleist, called in German Über die allmähliche Fertigung der Gedanken beim Reden, in English it is translated in On the Gradual Construction of Thoughts During Speech. So it is kind of a short treatise addressed to Kleist's friend, Otto August Rühle von Lilienstern. And it is actually on the development of thought through speech. The text does not have like a strict logical structure. It is more like presented in the mode of a stream of consciousness. So it like kind of moves from one thought to the next. And it illustrates the gradual construction actually through several like discourses, disjointed discourses. And at the end, I would say it is actually a text that performs like the process it describes, namely construction.
Yeah. And so this text, you also identify several dimensions that are relevant in terms of autopoiesis. And one of these dimensions is addressing. So who's being addressed in Kleist's text, and how does Kleist's evaluation of addressing influence his own writing style?
Yes, the second question is a bit difficult, but the first, I guess, like I can try to answer that. So as I said, the text is addressed to Rühle von Lilienstern, and kind of the general argument at the beginning of the text is quite simple. So in order to initiate the construction of thoughts, you must have an audience. You must have somebody you can address the text to. And Kleist suggests that the construction of thoughts works best when you talk with somebody about it. And actually, it doesn't matter whatever it is, but so it happens, but it's like, in order to get to the point, you kind of have to address the text. And so it is kind of like something to stabilize the procedure that is the gradual construction. But of course, as I will, or, you know, if you read the text, of course, you will realize that never happens. There is still no definition. However, it seems that Kleist is suggesting addressing in order to start the gradual construction. So without the people he addresses the matter to, he cannot find anything out. So addressing is actually for starting like the construction of thoughts.
So it's like being helpful to him. I mean, I think you also write about him addressing his sister, and somehow it helps him, doesn't it? Is this talking to his sister is helpful to Kleist in order to reorganize his thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Because actually, he's telling. I mean, it is kind of mean, especially to his sister and to Rühle von Lilienstern, because he actually even tells they don't even have to understand the topic. So he talks about mathematics with his sister, and but tells like the sister doesn't know anything about mathematics or like some I don't know what else they are talking about. But he just needs an audience in order to start his own like. Stream of consciousness is his own thoughts.
So another dimension you deal with is interrupting. And here Kleist gives also several examples in his texts. But between them, there's always something like an interruption. And could you maybe say what this means? And do the interruptions have a special function?
Yes, I would say, yeah, they have a special function. And for like in terms of like the meaning of the interruption, I would just like quickly give an overview what are the stories of the text, where there are many. So like from the direct address to Rühle, Kleist moves on to like... to another example of gradual construction of thoughts that involves his sister. And after the example involving his sister, the next now is a historical example, namely Mirabeau's speech in France. And then he moves on to the class in Flas, to actually an example from physics. That's a Kleist in Flask is a condenser of electrical energy. And then he recounts the fable of La Fontaine. And then he talks about transmission. And then about speaking in society. And at the end about examination situations at the university or at schools. So it is actually an endless chain of examples. Means whenever one examples could come to an end, means when they could paraphrase or metaphorize the gradual construction, when the example could stabilize the meaning of the gradual construction, Kleist moves on to another example, an example that most likely doesn't have to do anything with the last example, and so on. And I think that is fascinating and actually has a lot to do with the situations we also, like in our daily life, we try to define something what is very difficult to define. And usually we like jump from one example to another because we will always find a better example. But through the jumping, through the interruption of the Gedankengang, of the chain of thought, we sabotage ourselves in our like goal of giving a definition. And that's exactly what Kleist is doing in his text. And that is like where I'm interested in is like interruptions.
Amazing. So a bit like day-to-day communication when you also use these examples.
Yes, exactly.
So you also look at repetitions. You just mentioned also the Mirabeau example. Could you tell about the repetition within this example and what it means for Kleist?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's not that the question of repetition is not only connected to the Mirabeau example. So
maybe you can choose another example.
I will come back to the Mirabeau example, but I think interestingly it is also what he says right before the Mirabeau examples, namely ich kehre zur Sache zurück, means I do return to the actual topic. But that is like, that's not true, because every example is the actual topic. And so every example just repeats over and over again the same, but like in a different way. So it is not so much different from like the interruption example interruption we just talked about. But through the repetition of the gradual construction, through this repetition, it is kind of performed. And so in performing what it describes, the text obstructs the possibility of a definition. And instead, like Kleist continues on with one example after another, never reaching a definitional point. But it is like in itself, it's always a repetition of the same topic, but only in other examples. And the same can actually could also be said for many other short texts from Kleist, like the Marionettentheater or a Marionette Theater, where it's about like description and definition of what grace is. But the graceful moment can never be reached consciously. So you always have to retelling the moment of grace in a different story to approach something like grace, but you will never get there. You will always find a better example. And so you're actually repeating the procedure with the result of an approximation. But as an interpreter, you will never find the core. And I think that's the same for like the gradual construction of thoughts, the text. Yeah.
Anyway, the second major text you discuss in your book is Franz Kafka's novel The Trial, also quite popular. And within this novel, you particularly look at its centerpiece, Before the Law. And this text deals with a man who wants to gain entry to the law but cannot get through. And could you say something about the relation between Before the Law and the rest of the novel? I guess you mentioned the word preamble.
Yeah, sure. I would say Before the Law anticipates the structure of the fragmentary novel. So a preamble defines, I mean, that's probably a kind of a very short definition, but I would say it defines how the law should be read, like something like the Geltungsbereich of the law, the purview of the law. And Before the Law defines somehow how the novel should be read. And of course, as you can imagine, that's where the problems are already it starts, because the content of Before the Law is anything than clear. And that's why it's so fascinating, paradoxical. So the advice of Before the Law is somehow a non-advice. So that's, I would say it is kind of a preamble for the trial, but it is at the same time a very weird preamble, because it doesn't really... It so shows how kind of like on a structural level, how the text is working, but it doesn't really, it's not a clear advice.
And one main term you use for describing Kafka's trial is a procedure of second order. And as I understand it, the procedure of second order is a kind of mise en abyme structure, which means basically that Kafka's novel is not only to be interpreted, but rather already contains an interpretation of interpretation. Is this right, or could you develop this idea a bit further?
Yeah, sure. So I probably will start not by Kafka here, actually. So the idea of a second order is actually kind of a simplification of Luhmann's idea. And I think Luhmann's idea is based here on Spencer Brown. So that means, so an observation, Second order observation means more or less like observation of the observation. And I actually more adapting it to how the secondary literature observes the trial. So in my case, it is Walter Benjamin, or you can also say Werner Hamacher observes Walter Benjamin's observation. So what I found out that all, especially in observing before the law, actually don't reveal the blind spot or whatever, but rather doubling what Kafka is doing. So actually, Benjamin does not define what is going on, but rather he uses the same parabolic picture as Kafka uses, just or just another metaphor. And I even would state it's the same for Kafka too. So in the cathedral chapter, that's a Domkapitel, there is an interpretation enclosed, the discussion between Kay and the priest, that it actually complicates the legend before the law, and not like helping us to understand before the law. So the hermeneutic observation are at the end senseless. They do not lead to a clear interpretation. However, they adapt the procedure of like something like a mystical or not so clear exegesis. So Kafka does it, Benjamin does it, and it seems also for me there is no possibility to get a hold on the interpretation. The only possibility to get close to the legend before the law is through an adaption. And this adaption seems to be endless. I mean, endless is probably the wrong word, but seems just to be repeated by Benjamin, by Hamacher, by myself writing about that text.
Yeah, interpreting Kafka is always a bit difficult, I guess, and finding an exact interpretation. But fascinating. Okay, so one last question. To sum up, could you repeat the key results that you have found in your study of Kleist and Kafka and clarify again what they tell us about autopoiesis?
So I would say autopoiesis is not describing a singular function. So how the function is described is highly dependable on who is asking. Biologists, theory of cognition, system theory, literary theory, etc. Every discipline seems to have explanations for self-creation or self-reference that are connected to their own epistemological interests, like their own Erkenntnisinteresse. So interestingly, most of the disciplines try to explain autopoiesis ex nihilo, means out of nothing. And that's actually funny for me because, so therefore, the definition of autopoiesis is itself autopoietic. So it is out of nothing itself produced. So, and even I don't really give a definition, and some people also have criticized that in my book, because I have more like of a historical view. And for that, I would say autopoiesis could be used for something I already mentioned at the beginning of this interview, of something that is like hard to describe, that is probably even harder to define. And that is very obvious for me. And, you know, we just talked about it, how difficult it is like to proceed with Kafka and actually also with Kleist. And there is something in those texts that is referring to itself that is even like to some level transcendent, but you can describe it, you can adapt it, but it is not definable. And for me, autopoiesis is actually a term for that, describing, first of all, of course, somehow like self-reflection, but also describing the problem of defining that self-reflection. So since I have the position of an observer, I can tell you that I cannot define, but only describe in another example and another example. And that is actually what I did in my book.
Oh, okay, Mr. Schmidt. I really appreciate you taking the time today. And it's an important book of yours, and I can only recommend it. So thanks a ton for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that very, very nice and interesting interview.
Thank you.